You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, June 11th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA, on the program today, Anya Kamenetz, on her book, The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing. But you don't have to be. Also on the program today, Rupert Murdoch, stepping down, handing over his empire to the guy who it looked like he was offering almost in some ways to take the fall for the hacking scam. Bratton, New York City's police commissioner, explains the reasons why the percentage of African Americans graduating from the police academy is at its lowest level since 1960. We may have arrested too many. Also on the program today, prepare to feel sick when I read you some of the science, in quotations, Louisiana school children are being taught with tax dollars. Florida attacks a woman's right to choose. Jamie Dimon douche-splains what banking is to Elizabeth Warren. And the things are moving so quickly in fast track, folks. No pun intended. We'll keep you up to date with what's going on. That it just crazy. And of course, an update on the clown car and Mike Huckabee's ghostwriter turns out to be an accused child molester. And I don't just mean like somebody on a website accused them of it. There seems to be significant documentation of these accusations. I don't know what it is about Mike Huckabee. He doesn't seem like a great judge of character. But I'll tell you something, very sensitive when the ladies swear around him. That he doesn't like. All that and more on today's program, folks. I guess maybe should we get to that story? No, we're going to have to jump to this. Let me just give you a quick brief update on what's happening with Fast Track Authority. We're going to talk about it more in depth as the show progresses, probably in the funner half. But it is so essential that you contact your congressperson if they're a Democrat. You tell them, you know, this whole plan that supposedly salvages cuts to Medicare is a ruse. And you tell them they must vote against Fast Track Authority. If it is a Republican, it's a little bit easier. You call them and say, oh, are you really going to allow us to have Obama trade? And the Heritage Foundation is watching you. The Heritage Foundation is now scoring this vote. And it's a little bit late, but there is. You can go to obamatrade.com. The right-wingers have gotten on it. And hopefully, I mean, this thing is moving so quickly. Things are coming out of the Rules Committee. I got to be honest with you. I barely understand what is happening. And that may be giving me too much credit. There are multiple, the rules are such, were set for this bill that TPA, Trade Promotion Authority, would be passed along with TAA, Trade Assistance. And the trade assistance supposedly helps workers who lose their jobs. They have to be passed simultaneously. But the Medicare funding for the TAA blew up in people's faces because it cut Medicare. So Pelosi, who was against the cutting of Medicare, supposedly worked out a deal with Boehner in which the bills would be separated and then contract so that it wouldn't look like Democrats were voting for cutting Medicare. It's unclear to me where that even lies at this point, but there was a bunch of other amendments that came out of this bill that that apparently either could get rubber stamped in the Senate or wouldn't have to go back to the Senate out of Paul Ryan's committee that bought a lot of Republican votes. And I'll go through the list later. But so there's so many moving pieces here that this is where activists can really play a role. And, you know, it's interesting, in The Hill today, they came out with 12, they had a piece on the 12 groups to watch in the trade fight. There was six of the trade supporters and six of the trade critics. AFL-CIO, Democracy for America, the EFF, the Sierra Club, National Resources Defense Council, and Credo Action. So head over to Credo Action and either sign the petition, use their tools to call your congresspeople. It's a big reason why I'm happy to have Credo Mobile sponsor the program, because Credo Mobile supports Credo Action. So we've talked about that. You can go to majority.fm and look up support our sponsors to get the deal. The deal's only going to last another couple of days. Go to credomobile.com/majority, or you can call them at 800-966-1665, offer code 501-882. But we're going to take a break. More important than any of that is to call your congresspeople, push back on this. Push back on this big. Make it up. Make people pay a price. There's a lot of moving parts, and any one small cog that could break down is helpful. All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Anya Kamets. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Anya Kamets. She is the author of The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, but You Don't Have to Be. And also a veteran education reporter for NPR. Are you still at NPR?
I sure am.
Great. So I got that right off the bat. Let's talk about, as a parent of an elementary age school child, I am aware that we just went through testing. I guess now it was about a month and a half ago. And intimately aware of how much this impacts her school year. And obviously, since you wrote this book, or since it came out, one of the things that you talk about, the opt-out movement, has grown, it seems, precipitously. But before we get there, let's go to let's talk about the first half of your book, where you give a history of essentially of testing, at least in the context of this country. Tell us where this sort of notion of testing as an assessment began.
Well, you know, educational testing has a long history. It sits right at the intersection of sort of America's belief in meritocracy and also, you know, equal opportunity. So the idea has been, at least since the 19th century, that we could use these scientific means or pseudoscientific means of psychometrics to measure intelligence and thereby, you know, identify people's IQs and then figure out how to ration educational resources to them, whether that means a gifted spot in kindergarten or a spot in Harvard's freshman class. But the problem is that, of course, you know, intelligence is not as stable and not as hereditary as scientists used to think. And so the idea of using, you know, bell curve standardized testing on students to discriminate becomes increasingly problematic, especially as we start to get into, you know, really basing our whole education system on the results of these tests and rationing funding, closing down schools, and evaluating teachers based on the outcome of these tests, as we've been doing since No Child Left Behind in 2002.
What's fascinating to me as you were retelling the history, and as far as I can understand it, it's there was two sides of a same coin. Like it seems that the testing started out where it was sort of like it was filtering, right? It was saying we were looking for who were going to be the stars, and that's where we would focus our attention. And then in the 60s, as we have social emancipation, testing becomes sort of the opposite, where we are using this to find out where there are problems, and ostensibly this is where we were going to pay more attention.
Well, that's exactly right, and it's important that you point to the 60s because, you know, testing was a frank instrument of discrimination for most of our history. If you think about, you know, if you've ever heard of those literacy tests that were applied during the Jim Crow era to deny people the right to vote, we did a form of crude intelligence testing at Ellis Island to figure out what immigrants we were going to let in. So we've always done that kind of discriminatory testing, but after Brown versus Board of Ed, there started to be a renewed focus on the use of educational testing to remedy inequities in our school system. And in fact, when you look at the high-stakes tests that are applied today, you know, all the mainstream civil rights groups back these tests, and they believe that, you know, we're going to use them to close the achievement gap and leverage resources toward, you know, so-called underperforming students or schools. But the fact is that these tests have never been shown to do that. And in fact, you know, you can't really say that diagnosis is the same thing as treatment. So, you know, that kind of argument, I feel like, has a lot of flaws.
Well, I mean, I don't want to belabor this too much, but I mean, you wrote because I just found it fascinating. Was it the same guy or at least the same sort of group of people who developed the IQ was also the one who coined the idea of eugenics?
That's right. So the father of psychometrics, Francis Galton, was this guy. He was a cousin of Charles Darwin, and he was both the foundational, scientific figure in psychometrics as well as the guy who coined the term eugenics. And even here in the United States, you know, very close associations, almost all the folks involved in the early history of intelligence testing were committed, quote unquote, scientific racists.
I mean, so and it seems to me that, like, I mean, if we were to sort of track this, right, where the testing starts off with a way to find out, like, we're going to separate the wheat from the chaff or the chaff, and and then it moves into an era where it's, well, actually, we want to find out where the so-called chaff is and make sure that we're actually bringing that chaff along. I mean, to belabor that metaphor, but it seems to me that in some respects, now we have a situation where testing has become ostensibly to help those who are not achieving, as it were. But in fact, it's doing the opposite. Like, I mean, it seems to me that now we have a situation, and I want to get your take on this, as to where ostensibly the testing is supposed to point us to where we have problems in the system. But it's actually a way of denying areas, places where we have those problems, more resources.
Well, I think that's, you know, and part of this has to do with, obviously, the way the tests are used. So, you know, when No Child Left Behind was first written, there were some provisions for carrots as well as for sticks, you know, extra resources for tutoring and that type of thing. But the problem is that the tests that we're using to make these really high-stakes decisions aren't super high quality. And so there's a lot of situations in which you can apply resources specifically to raise test scores. And you see this in a lot of so-called high-performing charter schools, which they are succeeding with high-poverty kids in raising those scores. But the problem is there's not a lot of other benefits that come out of that, because what they really have to do is then, you know, impose sort of a drill sergeant atmosphere to raise the scores in these tests, because these are, you know, multiple choice tests. They're not, you know, they rely a lot on memorization and very easy tricks and techniques. And so you're not developing the full learner. And even in an environment where you are kind of pressuring everyone to raise the scores on the test, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're improving the school environment or experience in a way that actually helps kids long term.
And it seems to me too that with No Child Left Behind, that the part of the problem was that there was carrots and sticks, but the carrots were never actually allocated. That there was a huge lack of funding. I mean, aside from all the problems, I think that, you know, sort of this high stakes testing regime creates, there it was woefully underfunded. But I mean, is that accurate? Is that accurate?
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, testing and punishing schools is obviously cheaper than, you know, remedying these huge inequities. And we have 51% of kids in public schools that are free and reduced lunch eligible. It's a far higher percentage in most of our urban districts. And, you know, we have kids dealing with a long list of issues before they ever get in the classroom door. And very few of our states across the nation even attempt to level the playing field for funding between poor and rich schools. So even though the United States spends a lot of money on education on a global basis, even as a percentage of GDP, the question is, where is that money going? And is it really going toward the wraparound resources that, unfortunately, so many of our kids need, because we do have such a scandalously high child poverty rate in this country?
Well, this gets to, you know, one of the dilemmas, I think, about that I felt in going over your book. And we're going to get to the sort of the solutions that you talk about, or I guess the alternative methods of assessment. But when we talk about the sort of the high stakes testing, I want to talk about, there seems to me to be like sort of two very distinct issues. One is whether or not the real issue is the inputs, insofar as, like you mentioned here, you have some kids who are extremely disadvantaged going into the system, versus what the outputs are, right? Which is, that's when you start to measure the assessments. Is the problem that we tie in too much of the resources to these assessments in the wrong manner, or is it the problem that the assessments are poor in the first place? I mean, what is the number one, I guess, problem that when it wrapped up in this? Because those two things sort of, they overlap, but they're distinct issues.
So if I had to break it down, I would say that the high stakes attached to these tests are really the issue. So if you say that these tests, you know, they're low quality, they're relatively cheap to administer, they tell you pretty limited summaries of students' abilities along the spectrum. But the real problem here is the fact that we are holding our states, our schools, our districts, our students, our teachers, our administrators hostage to these test scores. And the problem is, when you give people that kind of incentive, you know, you're going to lose your job, the kid is not going to get to go to the next grade, that's when you start to see a lot of these bad actions. And I don't know if you followed the cheating scandal or trial in Atlanta.
Yes, I did. But keep people tell people about that.
Well, I mean, there were felony convictions on racketeering charges for over a dozen educators. And the fact is that, you know, these people were really singled out for something that researchers showed us that happened most likely across 40 states in the last half a decade. So this is not a, you know, isolated incident. They really were singled out. And the fact is that if you tell someone their job depends on their kids making it over the line on this test and they have, you know, no resources, no extra help to make that happen, you know, I'm not going to say that it's excusable, but, you know, you can see that why that would be a rational response.
Right. And we should say there was a fantastic piece. I think it was in The New Yorker, or maybe it was Mother Jones. I can't remember. There was a great piece that showed it wasn't just necessarily about people's jobs, too. I mean, there was a lot of part of the incentive was like, we want to get resources to these kids, and this is the best way to do it. I guess different teachers had different motivations in that situation.
Well, I think that's exactly right, and I think that points out something really important. It was in The New Yorker, by the way, with these tests, we are telling a lot of kids that they are failures, and we're labeling them. And, you know, IQ is something that we always thought was hereditary and was fixed at birth. We're learning that that's really not the case. And it's incredibly damaging. You know, you think about how this affects a kid's mindset and their attitude towards learning and towards school in the first place. I hear all the time now from parents who say, you know, my kid used to love school. Now they're hating school because these tests are so stressful. And these might be really high-achieving, really bright, curious kids. You know, to say nothing of kids who have so many counts against them already. Maybe they come from a high-poverty background. And, you know, these scores basically are telling them, you are a failure. You're always going to be a failure.
Right. And so, all right. So if the primary problem is the stakes associated with the tests, is there a way, even if, and I want to go through sort of the alternatives that you recommend, but do we have that same problem even with those alternatives? In other words, or is it that these alternatives are such that it, the problems that accrue from the stakes, which is that school turns into a, you know, instead of just sort of we're going to assess how the school is doing, the whole school programmatically becomes just a focus on the test.
Right.
Is changing the assessments going to get us to where we want to be, or is it tying, or is it, I guess, sort of associating resources with the assessments? Is that the problem?
Well, to me, I talk about, you know, both of those things, but really primarily, you know, you have to change assessments and you have to change accountability. So if you look at the political reasons why we have the accountability system that we do, it's because people don't trust teachers, right? If you trusted a teacher's assessment of students' work, you wouldn't need to come in with an outside test that was produced by Pearson or somebody else and give it to the classroom. So why don't we trust teachers? Why are they not empowered? Why is there not transparency at a higher level to what goes on in the classroom? And some of these other assessment systems I talk about, like performance-based assessment, that is really about, you know, tying teaching and learning together and assessment together into all the same process and bringing teachers into a much more professional environment where, you know, I'm a professional, you're a professional. We don't rely on the results of outside evaluators to tell us that we're doing a good job. We decide together on our metrics. We know who we're responsible toward. And, you know, there's a kind of a consensus process that goes on there. And, you know, I would also submit that our definition of accountability up to this point really only goes one way. You know, schools have to make certain targets, states have to make certain targets, and if they don't, the federal government comes down on them. Well, a lot of people are starting to propose the idea of reciprocal accountability. You know, what is our state, what are our states, what is our national government doing to remedy the effects of inequality and the resources and the inputs that go into schools? You know, what about making it accountable the other way?
So, in other words, on one hand, you have the achievement gap, and I think I may be quoting you here. But on one hand, when you measure these outputs from the schools, you're talking about an achievement gap. When you measure the inputs, How well are we doing as a society in making sure that when those kids show up at the school at age 3 or 4 or 5, that they don't have a huge listening vocabulary deficit, or they don't have malnutrition, or they've been exposed to at least a basic minimum of experiences? Then you're talking about a resource gap, and you're talking about holding the federal government and, I guess, presumably various levels of government accountable for the resource gap.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And so, all right, let's talk about those alternative forms of assessment, because, well, or even before we get there, tell me what you make of, I mean, I think your book came out in January, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And it seems to me, at least in New York State, but I think certainly other places around the country, I mean, I think we've seen it like in Washington State as well, Seattle in particular, but other places around the country, that the opt-out movement has really grown significantly just in the past year. Now, I guess it's, you know, this new testing regime and Common Core is fairly new, and it sort of is transpartisan for various different reasons. But give me your sense of where that's leading.
Well, it's so fascinating, and obviously it was exciting for me because I got to talk to some of the opt-out organizers, and I knew that this was coming. They were all really confident that this season would be, you know, really the one that made national news, and it certainly was. And, you know, I think that it's really unique in kind of the history of American schooling. I mean, you have parents getting involved for all kinds of reasons in the public schools, but this is really a direct action of civil disobedience by parents. Who don't like what they see happening, and it's for a wide variety of reasons. It's bipartisan, it's middle class parents, and you know, I don't think it's likely to go away because, as I mentioned, you know, in a couple different arenas, you know, a lot of the objections that parents have really go beyond just the question of testing, but it's about, are our schools really preparing kids for the 21st century? Are we really, you know, are we emphasizing what's relevant, and are we using the resources we have for what's really important? And I think that set of concerns is really going to, you know, remain live even no matter what happens with the current tests.
Is there, I mean, when we talk about preparing them for the 21st century, I mean, and yes, I would say, like, you know, obviously there's a difference between preparing our kids in an agrarian society, post-industrial society. But what do we mean by that when we say in a 21st century? I mean, what does that mean?
Well, it's really fascinating. I think it aligns with a lot of what progressive educators have been saying for a long time, which is, you know, we can't predict what's going to happen in the economy. The job market's changing so fast right now that, you know, it's not that you prepare for one job and then go off and do that job for 40 years. So what does that mean? It means that we need to raise kids that are authentically curious, that are adaptable, that are resilient, that have a sense of self-efficacy, that they can, you know, they themselves are able to make decisions and take responsibility for their own lives. And, you know, they may need to be entrepreneurial. There's not necessarily that one job for a lifetime anymore. And so a lot of what you talk about when you talk about what's a successful person in the 21st century, you know, obviously confidence with technology and electronics and you know, some technical skills are in there, data literacy, media literacy. But a lot of them really align with this very humanistic outlook and philosophy of, you know, we need people that can collaborate. We need people that are leaders. And, you know, and they need to be generally empathetic and self-aware. So, you know, things that John Dewey would be happy about, things that if you send your kid to a Waldorf school, they'll talk about, a lot of those tend to be very 21st century type skills.
And that's the irony, I guess, of a Waldorf school, right? I mean, they don't... I think you're not supposed to read until you're in the first grade, I think, in a Waldorf school, as far as I can tell. I've had some minor experience in visiting one, and I just remember them,
right,
and not having any blocks, that there was no blocks. There was only segments of trees. I found that very weird, but I just didn't understand what the difference was between two cuts on a piece of wood as opposed to six cuts on a piece of wood. But let's leave that for a moment. All right. So give me a sense of those. You talk about, sort of broadly speaking, four, I guess, replacement versions of assessments. Walk us through those.
Sure. So I talk about Team Robot, Team Monkey, Team Butterfly, and Team Unicorn. And Team Robot is the idea that we could use some of the technology that we use every day and that more and more students are using, software-based, to kind of do a just-in-time data collection on students. So, you know, the idea here is back in the 70s, businesses used to have to close down, literally, to take inventory at the end of the year. And that's kind of what we do now with educational tests. But if you have students interacting with software every day, you know, you can kind of take the sum of everybody's scores, everybody's quizzes, everybody's homework, and sum that up and get a graph of their learning over time. And what that also does is it shows not just what they know, but also a little bit of how they learn, how they approach things, their persistence, how quickly they pick up new ideas. And so there are a lot of kind of researchers who are really excited about that, and that's kind of the Team Robot. It's a technical upgrade. It's not necessarily changing philosophies. So that's why it's one interesting kind of innovation.
So, I mean, what is that? What does that mean? Like, per se, like my daughter does her, does her writing in like one of those little composition books. Is the idea that they would do them on some type of networked, tablet or something? Or is that, I mean, what does that look like from a practical standpoint?
Sure, absolutely. So about 1 in 3 classrooms across the country are using some kind of type of software like Khan Academy or Dreambox. You know, and the biggest application for this is math, but there's also applications for language mechanics, for English and for foreign languages as well, just vocabulary, spelling. There's a basic grammar type of things, mechanics. So it's not necessarily so advanced over the multiple choice tests we have today, but it's just that there's more data involved.
Is that what you call like stealth assessment?
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny because my daughter comes home and plays some math like video games that they tell her at the school. And so the idea would be that you would actually sort of track her progress in this game, and it would be not just her progress, but she plays against, you know, all the kids in the class are on the sort of the leaderboard, as it were, or whatever it is. And
exactly.
And so you'd get a sense of how the class is doing through these games, and the kids wouldn't even know they were being assessed.
That's exactly right. So you don't have the problems with anxiety. You don't have the problems with, you know, maybe the kid was sick that day or they were off their game because you were kind of sampling over time. So that's one of the four. So the second approach that I talk about is called Team Monkey, and that's referring to sort of the social and emotional skills and the other half of the picture for success. You know, we talk about collaboration, creativity, leadership, empathy. You know, we're not really addressing that in our current assessment systems. And, you know, we don't necessarily have great tools in place yet, but schools are starting to use really simple things like self-report surveys, behavior and attendance records, to kind of just get a sense of the emotional health in a school. And I think that could be potentially pretty powerful as we start to look at, you know, what are the kinds of things that kids are coming into school with? How can we help them give them better tools to deal with the challenges that they face? And you know, really pay attention because mental health matters, relationships matter, and all of those things contribute towards students' long-term success.
You can actually find some of those type of things like on Great Schools. I've noticed as we start to look at middle schools in New York City, there mm-hmm. the teachers give a sense of like four different categories, you know, cooperation and safety and whatnot, and the kids give their assessment and the parents give their assessment, and I think the administrators give their assessment, and you get a sense of like, maybe there's a disparity between what the teachers think are going on and the students think are going on, or et cetera, et cetera.
That's right. You know, parents want this information. Students need this information. And it's not fluff. When you start to aggregate it over the long term, it can be really, really powerful. And Gallup is one of the organizations, the Gallup poll. You know, they have a student poll that was taken by 850,000 students last year. And it's starting to be incorporated in a low-stakes way into school assessments and school report cards, just as you're talking about in New York. And the idea is, you know, that this is going to be a good indicator. It's something that we need to pay attention to. It would be silly to attach high stakes to that kind of survey, but, you know, but to, as an indicator it for decision-making and to say more powerfully that this is something we need to be paying attention to if we want our schools to be full of happy, successful kids.
And you also talk about what is we've gotten the monkey, the robot, and yeah. the butterfly.
Right.
What's
the butterfly? Butterfly is really, it's project-based assessment. So it's the idea that you do an authentic assessment, a research project, a group project, and a presentation or a slideshow or some, you know, everyone's been to a science fair, but at these performance assessment schools, you know, there's 28 schools around New York that don't give Regents exams. They only have these kinds of assessments. And they're very broad-based. And the performance schools that I visited, I met with a student in New York and I visited one in Kentucky. They're really, really engaged places. You know, the students have an opportunity to pursue things that interest them, and they know that what they're doing is authentic because this is the type of thing that you do when you're a grown-up. You know, I had a 12-year-old kid tell me, let's get real. Nobody's going to be bubbling in answers at their job, but I will one day have to go up and give a demonstration of knowledge and answer questions and give feedback to my peers, which is what I'm doing in school today.
A 12-year-old said that to you?
Isn't that wild? He was so great.
Oh my God.
Wow. I can only hope. The fourth.
So the final one is I call it Team Unicorn, and the idea here is that games and simulations and some of the applications of technology coming very soon might be able to give us the same kind of high-level, authentic assessments of higher-order skills that we see with the Team Butterfly, but to do so in a data-rich and comparable way, right? So the problem with the performance-based assessments that we have now, it's hard to compare kids' performance across schools. You know, you don't necessarily have the ability to say that, you know, this school and that school are necessarily performing at exactly the same level. But, you know, in these games that people are building, you have students, you have people completing pretty high-level complex quests and tasks, as you do in some video games. And then the game engine is sort of gathering evidence about the decisions that they make while they're playing the game and using that to generate kind of some reports or some data that say, you know, we think that this student understands rhetoric. We think this student understands systems thinking at this level, you know. And so that's kind of the frontier in terms of assessment design right now.
So you, what happens assuming, I mean, is it, does there have to be a relinquishment of the sort of a big part of what is considered the school reform movement to get these different types of assessments? Or do, as these different types of assessments creep in, sort of bubble from the bottom up, as opposed to the top down, does it begin to undercut the problems that we have now with that reform movement, which is that it's so based on high stakes testing and it's really so much a winner takes all type of reform, I guess?
That's a really great question. You know, I think that there's good faith and bad faith people in the protesting camp. You know, there are people who are really interested in tests as an instrument of control, of, you know, they do not trust teachers. They want to ultimately see privatization. They want teachers' unions gone. And so they're never going to be convinced. Like, they're not going to relinquish this system or this element of control over schools, which they have in the form of high stakes. But there are also folks who really truly care about equity. They really truly care about rigor and high standards, and they see high stakes tests as the only way to enforce those for all children. And it's among those folks that I see an openness and a potential to new forms, better forms of assessment that can truly get at the things that we most care about. And building a consensus based on, you know, what we all believe is most important for kids. I think that there's hope there. You know, if you look at what's happening in Congress right now, there's a Senate version of a bill that would reauthorize No Child Left Behind. It has a new name now, the Every Child Achieves Act. And it would remove a lot of these stakes. It would give a lot more power back to the states to figure out exactly what types of assessments they need to be using, how often they should give those assessments, and even give them the ability to include some of these portfolio type approaches. So I actually am pretty hopeful, even though, you know, it's a funny kind of point in the cycle because people who have heard about the book come to me and they say, oh God, this is terrible. And I say, you know, it might be getting better now.
Yeah, it's funny, but is it are we sure that the states necessarily are not as susceptible to these same issues, or is it? I mean, because you know, Pearson in just New York State seems to me to be making a lot of money, and you know what I mean. Or is that different in different states, or is it you know, is it just Arnie Duncan is the Secretary of Education, and he comes from a very much this type of background and attitude. I mean, what is, or is it just sort of a mix of these things?
I think it's going to be, you know, you're right. It is going to be a mixed bag. And if it's not made, if the decisions aren't made at the federal level, there's going to be good and bad things happening at the state's level. But at least you have the, you know, you're no longer putting every state under the thumb of having the same types of tests at the same intervals and making the same decisions about it. And I think that, you know, there is a lot of political pressure, and even in a state like Texas, which, you know, is kind of the birthplace of all of this high-stakes testing, there's been a lot of action and a lot of kind of corrective actions in the last few years, as there's really been a backlash, you know, and it's a bipartisan backlash. So, you know, I think these things do evolve. There is a pendulum that swings back and forth, and unfortunately sometimes our kids are caught in the middle of that, but you know, over the next 10 years, I do believe that we'll see some meaningful changes.
All right. Let me just ask you one more thing, because, you know, I've talked to a lot of people involved in education over the years, and I tend to look at it just because of my nature and not being an educator per se, in the sort of the political dynamics of this. And it has always struck me that, you know, a good educators, although I've met, you know, I've talked to some people, you know, obviously like Diane Ryovich is really great at sort of taking these ideas in. It's always occurred to me that what makes a great educator is that there is no one size fits all remedy for any of it, because it's all sort of based upon who the kid is in front of you. And these the reform movement sort of strips away that autonomy and that sort of function of the teacher in some way. And educators coming out of the sort of a genuinely sort of from an educator's background have trouble, it seems to me, to articulate a political response to the reform movement, because that's just, it doesn't fit on a bumper sticker, and that's sort of the nature of what they do. Whereas for the reform movement, it does fit on a bumper sticker in some respects. I mean, so do you see this program as you know, and by program I mean these alternate assessments as both sort of a political tool and an educational tool, or which comes first, or is that question even relevant?
You know, I'm not a politician or an advocate. I'm a journalist who's trying to, you know, tell the story. And for me, I see the political action happening on several different levels. I mean, I think that the parents' revolt is really important, because, you know, it's hard to deny a parent who's very concerned about their kids' education. And what you're seeing now in places like Long Island is opt-out parents and opt-out organizers going into school boards, and school boards have always been the front door to our democracy. They're the first elected office for lots and lots of people. So that's really important. You know, as far as what's happening in terms of how assessments are changing, I do believe you need to offer an alternative. I think that, you know, as someone who would be making a case against high stakes or against mainstream education reform, the question is going to be, well, what do you got instead?
Right.
And that's exactly, you know, what this kind of evolution is talking about. And then the other thing is, when you start talking about, you know, different kinds of assessments, you're gaining some really powerful allies, because our nation's employers, the business world, the technology world, they want American graduates to be able to succeed and compete. They need people with these types of skills. And, you know, a lot of very powerful folks are incensed that our public schools are failing in this way. And they know that, you know, the way to get better is not necessarily going to be some kind of mechanistic solution, ironically. You know, that the idea that you have to get great creative teachers and empower them to do their work well you know, that resonates at the high levels of American, you know, both politics and business. So I think that that's, to me, that's a powerful tactic to take if I were giving kind of rhetorical advice.
Well, advice appreciated. Anya Kamenetz, the book is The Test, Why Our Schools Are Obsessed with Standardized Testing, but you don't have to be. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Great talking to you.
Bye-bye. Boop, boop. All right, folks, there you have it. We're going to head into our fun half of the program, wherein we will take your phone calls at 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. Tomorrow, we're going to put out some special bonus material for everybody. We've got a backlog of stuff. I did an interview with David Dayan that is for Ring of Fire, but it's on TPP. I want everybody to hear it as a reminder. We're going to put it out, I think, early in the morning as a reminder to call your congresspeople. Some stuff I did not know about Michael Froman and how this whole trade, you know, one of the things that had been sort of mystifying for people is just like, you know, why is President Obama pushing this so hard? So hard. Like, just the level of effort in this has been stunning in many respects. I don't know that we'll ever know the answer to these things because you can't know exactly what goes on in his brain. But but here's a little hint. Rubenitism. I don't know what the word is. So we'll be putting that out. We're going to put out a couple other a bonus material just to clean out the docket, the safe, the archive. I don't know.
There'll all be separate audio podcasts for you all.
That's right.
So you have multiple stuff to listen to over the weekend.
There you go. Also, if you want to be a part of the program, 646-257-3920, you can IM me via the app. Pick up the app. It's free, majorityapp.com. Don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. That's justcoffee.coop. Shipping is free now. With the 10% off, so good. Coffee's so good. And also, I will remind you that if you buy your crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link at majorityreportkickback.com. And the Credo deal can be found at credomobile.com/majorityreport. And if you forgot what I just said, go to support our sponsors. You'll get that information there. Somebody asked me the other day, is the Casper deal still up? Yes, it is. You can go to our website, see supports sponsors, get the Casper information. I think we're going to run an ad from them in a couple of days. All right, folks, see you in the fun half.